There were quite a few questions relating to consciousness and awareness. And so, rather than trying to answer individual questions, I'm going to just talk a little bit more generally. But I'll read the questions. I have trouble teasing apart awareness, perception, and consciousness. I think of awareness as a huge blank screen on which form and feeling get written. Perception knows what they are. Then I'm lost figuring out where consciousness fits in. Do we become aware of awareness from the knowing of objects arising within it, or does it have its own knowing consciousness? Knowing meets object, like sheaves of wheat leaning on one another. What about different objects being known at the same time? Different sounds like music, or sound, sensation, smell, and taste all happening at once, being known or held in awareness at the same time. Is this one consciousness meeting objects? Confusion about sensing the knowing of consciousness with the knowing of awareness. Feels almost like awareness surrounds and consciousness is inside. Can you speak to this? So, I think this area, it makes a lot of sense to me because the questions that are coming, because awareness and consciousness seem to have some similar properties and similar things going on. And so what is the difference between sati and vijnana? First, what I'll say is that perhaps I have some little like understandings here and there that have supported a kind of a noticing or recognizing a little bit of the difference between these at times. It's not crystal clear to me, so just to start there. So if you're still having trouble with distinguishing them, welcome to the club. It's not really clearly distinguished in the suttas, as far as I can tell. And even between perception and feeling and consciousness, it's not so clearly distinguished between them. So there's been discussions about this for centuries. So probably not going to find the answer today. And yet, what I want to point us all to is what's supportive for practice. Not just can we tease apart these concepts and then say, oh, this is that and this is that, but what's supportive for us in our practice? So trying to frame it in these terms. While I was reflecting on this before, there were many little threads that kind of flitted through. It's like, oh yeah, that's an interesting piece to explore, and that's an interesting piece. And I have no structure here, so it's going to just kind of be mixed media art. So, first thing I'll explore is that there is a difference, and that we all know there is a difference between knowing this function of consciousness and mindfulness. Because, so just to point how we know this difference, when we're lost in thought, really lost in thought even sometimes. And so mindfulness is not present. We are not aware really of where we are, what we're doing. We are in the world of our imagination, of our imagining, living, speaking, talking to that imagining. And we're driving down the freeway. And we are taking the right exit to get where we need to go. And so no mindfulness. And sometimes we get to that place, it's like, whoa, that's scary. I was not at all aware while I was driving. You know, it's like, yeah, we can do that. Not mindful while doing major activities in our lives. And yet the five aggregates are taking care of us. We are perceiving and feeling and recognizing and you know, knowing where we are. And so the five aggregates in general function without mindfulness being present. We can be mindful or not, and the five aggregates will just be taken care of us. So feeling, perception, consciousness, mental formations, body, all tumbling on, whether we're mindful or not. And so that's one piece of the puzzle that I find useful for practice that we can recognize. And Sayadaw sometimes says that, you know, when we kind of wake up to, when we wake up to being here, you know, sometimes we can know what has just been happening. And why do we know that? Because perception and feeling and consciousness were doing their job. They were functioning even while we were not mindful. This was a clear experience for me at one point on a retreat. I was sitting in the dining room on one retreat and spaced out, you know, thinking about something else and mind kind of wandering and then thinking about things going on. And then the mindfulness returned really clearly. And in that moment of the mindfulness returning, I recognized that I knew what had been going on. So perception and feeling and consciousness doing their job while the mind was wandering. And I could play back in my mind. Yeah, that person came in, did a few things, they left. And this other person came in, did a few things, and they left. And it was kind of mystery to me. And I went and actually asked my teacher, it was Gil at that point, I said, what's the difference here? You know, I remember there was some kind of awareness, something going on there. So what's the difference in these two? And he says, it's vast, the difference between these two. This is really where freedom or delusion lie in, or the freedom or just staying caught in the cycle of suffering. Because when we are not clearly aware of what we are aware of what's going on, our habits and patterns are generally running the show. And then when we do become aware, when mindfulness arises, there's the possibility of that recognition of what's actually happening here. What's the experience in this moment as a human being? What's the human experience of this? And that does have to be that orientation towards wise mindfulness, because as we talked about earlier in the retreat, there is the possibility of wrong mindfulness, of mindfulness motivated by greed, aversion, delusion. And so that mindfulness in returning that orientation to curiosity about what's here right now. And so one way I would distinguish awareness or mindfulness and knowing is that in the mindfulness, we know that we know. It's a self-reflective capacity. It seems to me that mindfulness makes use of all the aggregates to know what we know. It's not simply like knowing. The description of knowing in the suttas is really very bare. It's seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, taste consciousness, tongue consciousness, mind consciousness. And so knowing, basically, you know, in that kind of very bare way, recognizes this is a sight, this is a sound, this is a smell. It doesn't really, well, there's different perspectives on this. I actually recently read a note about this very question. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his notes, says, some of the commentaries assign a discernment power to consciousness, that it actually discerns differences. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, you know, this doesn't jibe with what's in the suttas. So I don't quite see how the commentary or why the commentary says this, because the description in the suttas is just this really, like, it's discerning between difference between hearing and seeing, but that's about it in terms of the consciousness aspect, the knowing aspect. And so awareness, like, there's the sentence that kind of, to me, encapsulates what awareness is, what mindfulness is. I'm using awareness and mindfulness synonymously here. The Satipatthana Sutta, you know, describes how we establish mindfulness, but doesn't really define mindfulness. The sentence that comes as close as possible, that comes as close as we can, the definition section of the Satipatthana Sutta to define what mindfulness is, defines it in terms of what we know and how we know it, how in terms of what we are aware of and how we're aware of it. And so the phrase is something like, how is one mindful of the body? One abides, observing the body as a body. Ardent, mindful, clearly comprehending, having abandoned desire and discontent for the world. And so the first thing we see about this definition is it's recursive. It includes mindfulness within it. It's defining mindfulness, but it includes mindfulness within it. And so it doesn't really tell us what mindfulness is. And yet some of the examples, some of the instructions give us a little bit of a clue as to what mindfulness is. Breathing in, one knows one is breathing in. Breathing out, one knows one is breathing out. So this is speaking in ordinary language to us to help point us to a function of mind that's really useful. One that is not always present in our minds. It's not always true that breathing in, we know we're breathing in, breathing out, we know we're breathing out. And I just want to say, you know, that's, we may not be aware of breathing in and breathing out when we are mindful of something else. So, you know, just that if we are mindful, it doesn't necessarily mean we would be mindful of breathing in and out. And so there's that simple, you know, just that simple instruction or that simple pointing. Breathing in, one knows one is breathing in. And this is kind of through the text. Feeling a pleasant feeling, one knows one is feeling a pleasant feeling. Feeling an unpleasant feeling, one knows one is feeling an unpleasant feeling. When greed arises in the mind, one knows greed is arising in the mind. This is the description of what mindfulness is. Consciousness, on the other hand, happens all the time. You know, every single moment of our lives. I don't know if we get put under anesthesia, whether consciousness is there or not, but I think it probably is. You know, I don't think we go flatlined there. But in general, you know, through our lives, every moment of our lives, waking or sleeping, there is some form of consciousness. And so consciousness is not like mindfulness. Mindfulness comes sometimes, goes at other times. Consciousness always present in every moment of experience, whether we are mindful or not. Now back to this reflection on mindfulness, using the aggregates to be aware. So that sentence, breathing in, one knows one is breathing in. So this is the body, the movement of the body happening. And so mindfulness connecting to the bodily experience here in this example. It's not just the bodily sensation, the feeling is happening too, and that actually is maybe how we even know something is happening through this feeling tone. And so this whole package of being aware includes, and even that description, while breathing in, one knows one is breathing in. It's like the breathing in is a perception. It's a recognition. And so mindfulness using perception, mindfulness using feeling, mindfulness using knowing to meet and know that it knows. So sometimes for a while I wondered if mindfulness was just knowing itself. But I think it's more of the aggregates than that. Because there is often this quality of understanding what is known, what we are aware of, the perception of it, the feeling of it, the sensations of it. So the difference or knowing mindfulness and knowing consciousness, I think one of the important, it's really important to become in our practice, one of the most important things I think is to become really familiar with what it feels like to be aware in this way of being mindful. Because just as when I described that to Gil, it's like, I see that, there's knowing that happens whether I'm mindful or not. What's the difference? It's like, yeah, this is important. Know this difference. Know the difference between what it's like when you're aware and what it's like when you're not aware. And that difference is, can kind of be clear in that moment of the mindfulness returning. And we know this, it's like, don't second guess yourself too much in this. And so that recognition that we know mindfulness is here, we know that we're aware, that's an important distinction to understand in the mind, in our practice. And partly because when we clearly know this quality of mindfulness, we understand its value in terms of helping us learn about our hearts and minds, understand its value in terms of helping us discern what suffering is and what freedom is, what absence of suffering is, what qualities help support the movement towards freedom from suffering. And so really important to know that. And you all do know this. And so don't second guess that you know what it's like to be aware, what it's like to be mindful. Being aware of the knowing. Now this one's a little more, mysterious or unclear at times, although there are times in practice when, I used that gesture this morning of holding my two hands together, and or maybe it was yesterday, and saying, there's the object, one hand represents the object, the other hand represents the knowing, and that awareness can look from one side or the other. kind of be aware of the object more, or the knowing more. And so awareness has this kind of flexibility to take in the qualities of the object versus the qualities of the knowing. And it's useful, again, in practice, what can help us. It's useful to begin to recognize this difference between the object and the knowing. Even though they happen right together, you know, they happen at the same time. So, you know, it's not like we can tease them apart and say, I see only the knowing. Sometimes when people describe something, they say, oh, I'm just resting in the knowing. There's no objects. My sense is that there's an object that they're not familiar with, that knowing is kind of meeting, and that they don't know what the object is, and so they just say they know the knowing. And this kind of experience happens in meditation, actually, quite a bit, as the mind gets more and more letting go of its ordinary ways of perceiving and recognizing the world. So the recognition of the difference between the object and the knowing of the object, that mindfulness can know that difference, you know, as a couple of reasons why that's useful. One, it can help us, as I pointed to yesterday, see where we may be clinging. And so in seeing aversion, you know, aversion is the experience of aversion being unpleasant. The object aversion is reacting to unpleasant, and the aversion itself unpleasant. And then experiencing with mindfulness the knowing of that aversion, really the unpleasantness is kind of a major quality of that. And then as the mind shifts, curious perhaps about the knowing of aversion, that experience being neutral, there's the recognition of how the mind kind of clamps down around the unpleasant. Because as the mind shifts to the neutral quality of knowing, knowing itself is just neutral. As it shifts to that, there's a different experience in the mind, and a recognition of the kind of the holding around the unpleasantness in the object and in the aversion. The other piece around recognizing the knowing as a piece of our experience. Is that it is the subtlest of the aggregates and the easiest, I think, to impute permanence to. We impute permanence to the others too, but because it's so hard to see, and because there is this sense of a continual stream of knowing, you know, the mind just kind of like this thread just from the beginning of my life, even if we don't know, you know, we're not mindful all the time, but there's this kind of sense of looking back over my life that, yeah, that kid on the playground having those things, that was me. And you know, this teenager doing all these things, that was me. There's like some kind of continuity we pull through it. And some of that has to do with it feeling like it's the same consciousness that's pervading it all. And this is a place where the Buddha, you know, points to, we cling to whatever seems to be stable. And so we cling to this notion of consciousness. And so he pointed us to curiosity about this. In all of the aggregates, he's pointing us to the curiosity about the quality itself, and recognizing the insubstantial nature of it. Because we cling when we believe it's substantial, when we believe it has an inherent existence. We can begin to recognize an object, a sight and the knowing of it, a sound and the knowing of it, a smell and the knowing of it, and recognize, you know, when that smell goes, that knowing of that smell goes, it's that kind of that codependence of that object and that knowing, that consciousness, that we start to see we start to see the sense consciousness as being coming and going, because it is pretty clear that the sound of that motorcycle, whatever it is, you know, it's there for a little while. And now I don't hear it so much. I don't hear it anymore. And so the consciousness of the motorcycle is gone. And yet we impute a kind of a permanent, almost a kind of like, well, the hearing consciousness is just going along and along. But when we start to really observe what's going on, there's just these kinds of moments, hearing arising and passing away, seeing arising and passing away. And this, it's useful to see this because it begins to undermine the belief in the stability, the essential nature of consciousness. And the question about what's going on when multiple things are happening at the same time, it feels like we're aware of multiple things at the same time. This is mindfulness. The consciousness, the hearing, smelling, seeing, all these things happening, moments of experience arising and passing away. As we've explored a little bit, when we are aware, at times the experience is felt in different ways. Sometimes it feels like we know one thing at a time. We're aware of one thing at a time. The attention kind of moves to one thing, then another, then another, then another. Sometimes it feels like it flows from one thing to another. Sometimes it feels like it pops from one thing to another. Sometimes it feels like we know many things at the same time. This is mindfulness, knowing or aware of how it's knowing all of these aggregates at the same, how it's knowing the aggregates. So attention, it's knowing how attention is working. It's knowing this wide angle versus narrow angle, which may be partly related to the knowing of the object. As I mentioned this morning, the knowing kind of takes the shape of the object. And so that narrow versus wide experience may partly be related to the knowing itself. And that this sense of knowing many things at the same time, you know, that can be the experience that it's like we do experience that many things are happening simultaneously, and that's the way it feels like mindfulness is taking things in. And so that's, you know, you don't have to try to kind of decide or determine, well, is that actually that the awareness is time slicing very fast and it just feels like I'm knowing everything at the same time. And really it's just all of these knowings coming and going. And so knowing is always coming and going. And so I can't see many things at the same time. One thing I really appreciate about the Buddha's teachings is that he encouraged us to notice how the experience is in the moment. In certain places he's describing experience and it's, you know, it's pretty clear he's describing it in a kind of a, almost a more conventional way. You know, it's like, he describes sometimes that we can cling to deep states of concentration. And when I read that sutta, it sounds like he's saying, yeah, you can cling while you're having that state. You can hold on to that state and you'll suffer. And so he's interested in the suffering. He's not so interested in defining reality. And so the whole like commentarial tradition kind of stands on its head to define, well, when there's a wholesome state in the mind, there's not an unwholesome state in the mind. And so that clinging and that state of jhana, they can't be happening at the same time. So it's mind moment of this and a mind moment of that. So they're like, you know, standing on their head to kind of describe or explain what the Buddha meant when he said, yeah, you can cling to those states. And to me, it's like, this is the experience at times. That it's like, the experience is we're experiencing many things at the same time. We can be experiencing aversion and have delight in the knowing of it at the same time. Wholesome quality, unwholesome aversion happening at the same time. And again, the Abhidhamma kind of says, well, this is a time slice thing. But the Buddha actually didn't teach the Abhidhamma, is my understanding. He taught, notice what your experience is. Is there clinging? Is there a sense of understanding suffering? Is this way of paying attention supportive to release of suffering? And it's so clear that this experience of delight in the knowing or delight in the awareness of aversion, you know, in there's no question. You don't have to ask somebody, is that helpful? You know. And so this is a piece of what I want to convey here tonight. You know, trust the sense of the, this direction of understanding suffering and understanding the wholesome qualities and what leads to the freedom from suffering. And so this experience of knowing many things at the same time, to me, this is actually one of the hallmarks of this kind of practice, actually. In the Mahasi practice, for me, that didn't happen so much. But in the Mahasi practice, we were really aimed at knowing a single experience. We noted some single experience at a particular time. And so that was training the mind to do this kind of one thing, then another thing, then another thing. In this kind of practice, we're much more coming at the practice from a more, almost like our everyday minds is where we start. And in our everyday minds, this sense of knowing many things at the same time happens. And so that's the experience. You don't have to doubt that and say, well, what's really happening is X, Y, and Z, and I should try to see that. I should try to see this time slicing. And so, and I don't think we really need to know so much. Is this one consciousness? Is this many consciousnesses? Is this really a whole bunch of experiences? Or is it one thing? You know, what's the experience? Is there the understanding of awareness and a sense of the recognition of, is there suffering? Is there freedom from suffering? So much, this is the aim of our practice. And so all of the teachings are pointing to this. Pointing to how understanding consciousness, the insubstantial nature of consciousness, is conducive to freedom, is conducive to non-clinging to consciousness, is conducive to not creating a sense of self around consciousness. A sense of self, also suffering. So that's the aim of the understanding here, not kind of some, I mean, I'm really grateful the Buddha had this mind that could describe all of these things and tease them all apart to help us understand our suffering. But I don't necessarily think we have to have the same, like full teasing apart as the Buddha did. He's pointing to many, many different ways we can understand suffering and freedom from suffering. Many tools, many, many approaches. There's a story in the suttas about a monk who, I think he maybe had, I was a little slow in understanding. And so he couldn't remember the teachings very well. He was not able to really hold on to the concepts so well. And the Buddha gave him this simple instruction of holding a white cloth and rubbing it. And just being with that and noticing what happened. And as he rubbed this cloth, the oils in his hands and the dirt and stuff created stains on the cloth. And from this, he gained some understanding. Did he become fully awakened? Don't remember. Anybody remember? I'll look, see if I can look it up, let you know what his outcome was. In any case, you know, the Buddha, to that student, I don't think the Buddha would have, like, elaborated the five aggregates. Just simple. And so, too, this practice can be really, really simple. Now, for some minds and certain times, some of us can understand pieces of this, of these aggregates, pieces of how we might cling to these various aspects and the suffering that's created from the clinging. And if we're understanding any of that, this is helpful. You were right, Diana. When I told Diana I was going to start with these four questions, I said, I think I'll probably take about 20 minutes for these. And she said, no, you'll take 40 minutes. 40 minutes. let me just see if it feels like that's enough. Sit for a moment. Well, I'll try one more. This one is about noticing identities and the exploration around where the Buddha taught his son, cultivate the perception of impermanence, and this will undermine the conceit I am. And so this question about how the practicing perceiving with impermanence supports this seeing through identities. senses of self. In practicing with impermanence, the arising of a fixed identity shows up, an identity in relationship to where I was born. Awareness sees this arising. Still, I don't see how impermanence can penetrate this if it doesn't first see first the selfing in it. Intellectually, the perception of being from somewhere comes and goes. And also it feels like a solid rock. So I think this speaks to, you know, really how tenacious identities can be, and how, in a way, even though the recognition, for instance, and my sense of this, and for myself, for instance, one strong identity that I had was being miserable. And, you know, I could see, this is really before I started practicing, but, you know, there's a strong sense of, yes, I'm a miserable person, you know, always miserable. And there were times when I was happy, but what my mind did with that was something like, well, I'm happy now, but I know that what I really am is miserable. So this kind of imputing of that identity around miserableness, kind of being somewhere stuck in my body or somewhere stuck in me, and that it was always there. And it was just, sometimes I was aware of it and sometimes I wasn't, but it was always there. I think a lot of our identities have this quality that we, they're so strongly conditioned that we can see that we're not always like in that state. But if we even think about it, we're there. You know, so it's like, well, it's there. You know, it's like every time I look, it's there. It's not here. Is it there? Yep, found it. So this is a lot of how the strength of selfing works, you know, that we really hold on to these senses of self, attribute a permanence to them. We can, through observing the coming and going. I mean, initially it is kind of like this, where it's like, yes, the sense of that identity arises and passes away, but it's more like, well, it's not obvious now, but I know it's lingering in there somewhere. You know, so there's that kind of, still there's this imputation of permanence, even though we're seeing it coming and going. This is the seeing of being aware of it, not being aware of it, you know, seeing the sometimes we're aware of it, sometimes not. But when we're not aware of it, still imputing permanence to it. This is concept. And this is the idea of that identity. And basically, what hasn't been seen through is the concept. And so this maybe is what the questioner's pointing to, is seeing that concept. Is like, if we can see that it's a concept, maybe we can see through its fixed nature. That it's not a fixed thing. And this is one way, absolutely, to seeing through identities. We begin to recognize that this is an idea. This is This is just a kind of a holding on to some kind of a, like my miserableness, you know. It's like, oh, that's an idea that I'm always miserable, but I'm not miserable now. With the continued exploration of experience, and continued seeing of experience arising and passing. But again, you know, if experience arising and passing isn't what you're seeing, there are other ways that we can see through identities than seeing the arising and passing of it. So I just want to put that out there. But the seeing of impermanence is a way that we can see through fixed views, fixed identities. And to me, the way this has been powerful in certain cases, I mean, certain identities, certain like, you know, big whole chunks of identities around, you know, one big chunk of identity around anger at a particular person, you know, that whole identity in my experience, you know, it disappeared when I wasn't looking. You know, I wasn't trying to see through it. I just kind of set it aside and went, just not with aversion, but just set it aside and turned to something else. And just over time, that just setting it aside without aversion was just a gentle, like letting go, until it finally just disappeared without my ever seeing it disappear. And so I wouldn't say that I saw the impermanence of that identity. And it vanished. So that's, I just want to say there's many, many ways to see through things. And so you don't have to hold this teaching that he gave to his son, you know, the cultivate the perception of impermanence. This will undermine the conceit I am. You know, you don't have to, think, oh, I need to see the impermanence of this in order for this identity to go away. There are many ways the mind lets go. I think this speaks to the many different teachings in the Buddha offered, and the different ways of practicing and different ways freedom can happen. But in any case, to speak to this question about how impermanence, seeing impermanence might undermine an identity or might create the release from an identity. When the mindfulness actually sees, often I'd say what we notice when we notice an identity is kind of the identity's there and we become aware of it after it's been there for a little while. And so we haven't really seen the arising of the identity. We've become aware of the identity after it has already arisen. And so in that case, we're not really seeing the arising of the identity. And then sometimes we lose interest in that identity. The mind goes elsewhere. That identity fades. And then we're aware, oh, that identity's not there. But we haven't really seen it vanishing. So we notice that it's not always there, but we haven't seen the arising of the identity. We haven't seen the cessation of the identity. This kind of awareness, when we see the impermanence in terms of how that identity is put together in the moment, it arising, seeing the threads being put together to build it, in the moment, we understand in that moment as we see it arising. This was one of the understandings that came in my practice around the identity of self-hatred. Seeing at one point the arising of the thought of self-hatred and how the whole belief construction around that was just being created in the moment. In that seeing of that, in that experience, in the seeing of that, there was the deep understanding that that self-hatred had not existed. It did not exist before it put itself together. That was a very powerful understanding in that moment around the self-hatred, because there had been the imputation of permanence to it. It's sitting in there waiting, just waiting. And in that moment, the mind saw how it picked up this thread and that thread and this thread and wove it all together. There's the magic, self-hatred. The magic of self-hatred arising and being believed, woven together, seen, constructed in that moment, kind of seeing in effect the magic show that had been woven together. That understanding was so liberating, because in subsequent times, and it did not mean that I never experienced self-hatred again, although boy, it did a number on it. You know, it really sliced into the believing of it. And so while the thoughts of self-hatred came, you know, the belief in it was really minimal. And so the arising of those thoughts in subsequent times was understood through this perspective. This is just an arising. This has no inherent reality, because that had been seen. And so this is a way that the seeing of the impermanence of an identity can be very, very freeing. And as I've said, you know, this is not even the most common way that my own patterns have shifted and changed, the weakening and, you know, lessening of clinging around various identities. And yet, in that seeing of it, it's very powerful. And so, you know, the understanding that it's useful to cultivate this perception of impermanence, yeah, there's a trust in that. It was really helpful. And yet it may not be the perception of impermanence that is freeing in another situation. Maybe another understanding. That feels like enough. Let's sit for a few minutes.